Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to another episode of Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. In this episode, we're dipping into entertainment of all kinds. Music, theater, reality television, you name it. We'll learn how folks are using these different mediums to share their stories and make their names known. We've got local filmmakers, the legacy of Prince, and an exclusive interview with Minnesota's own Maude Sun. Stick around. Let's get things started with your reality TV fix. When a new hit reality show came to town for auditions, producer Ben Hollum stopped by to survey the scene.
Love Island USA is an American dating reality show based on the British series Love Island. In the series, a group of contestants, referred to as Islanders, live in isolation from the outside world in a villa in Fiji under constant video surveillance. The core premise of the show is that these contestants, all young singles, have to couple up with one another in order to avoid being eliminated from the competition. The winning couple receives $100,000. The first season of Love Island USA aired last summer, and, a couple weeks ago, a casting call for the second season of Love Island was held at Surly Brewing in Minneapolis. Curious about who would try out, I attended and spoke to some of the hopeful contestants.
My name is Manu, I'm 22 years old, and I was actually curious about the type of people that would audition for this, but I saw the water bottles, and these are literally the ones that they use on the show, and I was like, I have to have one. So the only way to get one is if you audition, so I did.
What would you do if you ended up on the show anyways?
Bro, I got a job. I don't know. Like, I don't think I'm going to make it that far. I really feel like I don't have what it takes. What it takes being, like, a slight bit of insanity and, like, a good bikini body, and I have neither of those things. I think I'm very level-headed. And I have a horrible bikini body, so I'm not going to make it.
Yeah, so my name's Tucker. I recently broke up with my girlfriend a few weeks ago, and one of my friends is in town, and so we were looking for stuff to do, and it seemed like a fun thing to find out and try out. So,
what would be your strategy to win?
Well, so you want to be friends with a lot of people, because honestly, I haven't watched a lot of Love Island. From what I've seen, you want to be able to, like, switch it up and be able to work with, be compatible with a lot of different people. So try to be open, try to be friendly, try to not make a lot of enemies and keep it a generally positive vibe throughout the whole thing.
While I was at the auditions, I also had the chance to speak to Elizabeth Weber, the winner of the previous year's edition of Love Island, about her experiences on the show, her decision to enter, and whether she had any strategy to win going in.
And being on the show was absolutely amazing. It was such a unique, adventurous experience. I met so many friends. I found love on the show. I won some prize money, which was amazing too. And I just came out of it with so many stories and memories. So I was originally contacted by being DM'd on Instagram and had replied back and was like, oh, you know, I don't know if this is a good fit for me. And they were like, no, just hear us out. Like, yeah, so then after some of my initial conversations, I was like, I love these people. I love the ideas. And the conversations that we were having and the route that they wanted to take was so lighthearted and comedic and fun, and it wasn't, you know, the drama and super soapy, and I just was like, you know what, yeah, this is a great fit for me. And then I was like, okay, now I really would like to do this and want to do this. And then when I found out that I was going, I was just like beyond excited. This is actually something I have never announced before. I did read the book The Art of Seduction, and it was awesome. But yeah, you know, the minute I, like, camera started rolling and I stepped on a set and coupling up started, I just feel like any plan I had went right out the window, and I was like, I'm going home in the first week. I also didn't pack enough clothes because I thought that I would be someone voted out pretty quickly.
Of course, finding love is not all that Love Island is about. Many participants in the auditions were also interested in the fame that participation in a reality show can bring.
What would you want to do if you got on the show?
Gain so much clout.
How would you gain clout?
Just from, like, viewers, I guess, you know, right? Well, also, like, that'd be cool to find someone. Or, like, to connect with people and network and, like, have friends. Like, make new friends. You know, that's always cool. But also, with the open mind that I could possibly find someone. But the thing is, I'm not sure that everybody would be in it for the best intentions.
Elizabeth Weber is a good example. After her participation on Love Island, her Instagram account now has over 200,000 followers, and she sees the fame she's garnered from the show as a key step to where she wants to go next.
Yeah, I mean, what was so nice coming out of this moving forward is I have a really nice, supportive fan base, and just even family and friends that were so supportive of everything that I feel like it will hopefully open up a lot of avenues and different doors to just kind of explore and, you know, just kind of like see where things go.
It's hard to say if there's any one thing that draws people to try out for Love Island. The people I spoke to cited clout, fame, finding love, and the monetary prize. Almost no one, including last year's winner, seemed to take the endeavor entirely seriously, which is perhaps part of the power of reality television. It allows us to laugh at the idea of participating in it while we participate in it. We can find it ridiculous, and yet we all continue to watch it. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
On another note, film is a powerful medium for storytelling, bridging divides and sharing insights which might otherwise never reach an audience. But making a film is not an easy task, and it's often difficult for filmmakers to get established on a professional level, especially if the stories they want to share fall outside the mainstream. Over in St. Paul, one local program is looking to foster upcoming filmmakers with new perspectives. Bao Vu is a local filmmaker. Since early on in life, she remembers having a love for cinema.
So I grew up mostly in North Minneapolis, and my parents are refugees from Thailand, Laos area. I just remember, I don't know how we were able to afford a camcorder, but my parents had a camcorder, and I just started playing around with that, and just started making like silly videos with my siblings. And then later on, when we had like a computer, I just remember being able to edit and just really, really enjoying that process. Like, you know, it was a place where I could just practice using my voice.
However, at some point in her education, being a filmmaker fell out of the picture.
I kind of started exploring it a little bit more in college, but I just didn't feel connected to the people who were in the programs. It was mostly like white, male-dominated field, and the program was similar, and I just couldn't, like, I didn't know what it was at the time, but I just didn't feel connected. So I just kind of, like, forgot about it, and
at this point, Bao may well have left professional filmmaking behind for good, as is all too common with creatives of marginalized backgrounds.
Like, my ethnic and racial identity has definitely shaped my experiences a lot, and at the same time, I feel like I have unique challenges and miss out on opportunities because of my ethnic and racial identity as well.
And mainstream American culture and marginalizing certain groups has also made it more difficult for these groups to share their stories in the media.
So we chose the name New Angle because the program really hopes to like elevate voices that we haven't really heard in mainstream media. Check
which one. That's Jua Lee Grande, director of New Angle Fellows, a film fellowship offering an alternative to young filmmakers like Bao.
So mostly we choose people who are from underrepresented communities in mainstream media, so that whether that be BIPOC people, LGBTQ, women, etc. And so New Angle really is, the hope is to elevate stories that we otherwise have not seen from angles that we have not heard from.
To aid in elevating these new stories, the program goes beyond the technical side of filmmaking, teaching the fellows how to sustain themselves long term.
We focus on how to pitch your film, how to write a grant, because when you're starting out, maybe if you're lucky, you might get funded. But for the most part, you're just doing it in your free time until you learn the skills. But In this program, we're more so focusing on how do you get to the next step? How do you get the money to actually pay yourself and other people so that you can do this long term, mm-hmm. instead of just having it be kind of side projects. Right. In the program, all the fellows are required to work on a project.
During the program, each fellow works on a film project and then shares it with the community. Bao's piece, for example, follows three Asian American individuals who experience depression, a topic she hopes will resonate with her intended audience.
Like, I'm really creating this film for other people who do have depression, for them to feel like they're not alone and that this does happen to a lot of people and, you know, that this doesn't have to be an isolating experience. And I'm doing this for the Asian American community more specifically because there is this very strong stigma and shame when it comes to like your mental health. Like even in the Hmong language, there's no word to really speak to what depression is. And so like right now, it's really about the storytelling process and being able to have people empathize with one another in a way to like connect with one another too.
The New Angle program hopes to create alternative media for members of more marginalized groups by sharing their stories. Stories which might help process the individual experiences of others.
You learn more about like yourself and you learn more about the topic itself. And then you also learn to heal from it more too. And that's definitely been my experience. And that's what I've learned in the process of this film too.
So it's always really powerful to see a film go from an idea to like you're actually watching it with community. And oftentimes these are topics that are really powerful.
If you'd like to check out the films of Bao and the other New Angle fellows, public screenings will be held Fridays in May at the St. Paul Neighborhood Network. That's May 15th, 22nd, and 29th at the St. Paul Neighborhood Network off the Raymond Avenue Light Rail Station. On the topic of telling stories from outside the mainstream, producer Tosin Fasimo brings us a review of Nura, a play about immigration and the feeling of being an outsider.
A few weeks ago, I went to see a play at the Guthrie Theater. It was the first time I had ever seen a show there, so I wasn't really sure what to expect. I went alone, so I wasn't really sure how to act either, and I was pretty sure I stuck out in the audience.
It's mostly white people, which is interesting.
After a few minutes of waiting, the lights dimmed and people slowly stopped talking. On the stage, a woman appeared, standing alone outside on a dark and snowy night, smoking a cigarette and gazing at the sky. Her arms were crossed and her brows were furrowed. This is the opening scene of Nura, a play written by Heather Raffo, an Iraqi-American playwright. The play tells the story of Nura, an Iraqi immigrant. After 8 long years, she and her family have finally been granted U.S. citizenship, an event that sets the stage for the 90-minute drama. Nura deals with a challenge that many immigrants face. She struggles to hold on to her own culture while also adapting to the culture of the country that she's now in.
I know what it's like to live in a place in between, to not belong to just one place, to not be identified with just one identity.
That's Gamze Ceylan, a German-Turkish actress. She played the role of Nura in the play. When we spoke over the phone, she explained that there were a lot of similarities between her and the character that she played.
The German-Turkish culture is just they're such opposing cultures. So it was always this tug in between. As the Iraqi and American culture are so different as well, I can totally relate to that.
Gamze also described to me how her background allowed her to understand the difficulty Nura had in reconciling how to carry her culture with her after leaving Iraq.
I've lived in 4 different countries, so this place of bringing along with you the things that connect to home and your identity and your ancestors, where you come from, to keep that alive. The struggle of that and the tension of that, I could totally relate to.
In the play, Nura's struggles with identity are complicated by her young son, who's begun to forget what life in Iraq was like.
You're lost if you don't know where you come from. And for Nura, that's very much a point of tension. After 8 years of being in America, her child sounding like an American, trying to, you know, trying to instill in him my ancestors and trying to keep that alive in a place that has been destroyed. You know, Iraq has been destroyed. We can't just go back. So how do I keep that going in a place where I almost have no support at all?
This aspect of the play resonated with me on a personal level. It reminded me of when I was 3 years old and my parents decided to pack up their things and leave Nigeria. Their story was the same as that of almost all immigrant parents. They wanted a better life for my brother and I, and they felt America was the place they could find that. So they left behind everything and everyone that they knew and flew across the Atlantic Ocean with two small children and a plan to start their lives over. At the time, I was too young to fully grasp what was going on. I didn't think beyond the immediate situation. All I knew was that we were boarding a flight that would take us to a new place where I'd meet new people and experience a new culture. As I got older, adjusting to life in America was kind of strange. On my first day of kindergarten, every student got a name tag. I remember looking at my name tag and feeling a wave of embarrassment wash over me. My name didn't look like anyone else's. It wasn't a short English name. It was lengthy and hard to pronounce. It was foreign. I didn't have the words to articulate it, but it was the first time I had ever felt ashamed of being different. After the play, I found another person who could also relate to Nora's challenges with identity.
My name is Inas Alnabi, and I am volunteering at the Iraqi Reconciliation Project part-time whenever I'm available.
The Iraqi American Reconciliation Project is a Minneapolis nonprofit organization that seeks to bring together Iraqis and Americans in order to form friendships and build community. The group worked with the Guthrie Theater to bring cultural accuracy to the play.
There was somebody else who was also from Iraq. She was the cultural consultant for the play. I was just there as basically just an Iraqi refugee who lived in the U.S. and to just be able to kind of see where the play, get an idea of what the play is about and talk about how similar it is to the lives of the many Iraqi refugees in the U.S. and the process of coming to the U.S. and adjusting to life here.
Ines explained to me that she saw many similarities between her life and Nora's life as depicted in the play.
I was there for the opening night, and it was actually really, really good. I was really surprised at how great it turned out. I really enjoyed it. It was actually kind of very similar to my own story, to my family's story coming here to the U.S., and a lot of the stories I hear from other Iraqi refugees, the struggle that they have to face daily of trying to keep their culture, trying to keep their traditions, but at the same time try to adjust to life in this new country.
For me, watching the play brought up a number of complicated feelings. I'll admit I was initially skeptical when I read the synopsis of the play. The immigrant experience is a topic that's often inaccurately depicted in media. When I walked into the theater and saw the predominantly white crowd seated around me, I prepared myself for a watered-down version of what life in a new country is like. Instead, I saw the opposite. Nora's story was told with so much realism that I found myself fidgeting uncomfortably in my seat. It was as if I had been transported back in time, back when I was a little kid, before I had lost my Nigerian accent and my insecurities. Despite my discomfort, I found it refreshing to see identity discussed in a way that explores all the complexities within it. For Real College Podcast, I'm Tosin Fasima.
The late great Prince is arguably still the king of music in the Twin Cities. For any newer fans looking to experience his legacy beyond the music, reporter Casey McCabe has some tips on what to check out and when to expect some new, previously unreleased music.
The Twin Cities have always been a place of music, art, and culture, and no one else has embodied this ideal more in modern memory than Minneapolis's own Prince. During my time at the U, I've sought out new ways to experience Prince's legacy beyond his music, which ultimately led me to Paisley Park, Prince's home in Chanhassen, just outside the cities. I was lucky enough to interview Alan Seifert, the executive director at Paisley Park. While talking to Alan, I asked him how students at the U can experience Prince's legacy for themselves.
Well, I think the first answer is obviously Paisley Park. Paisley Park is both a creative hub and it was Prince's home. One thing I've discovered from people I've worked with here is that when you're driving by Paisley, it's a pretty nondescript corporate building. But once you walk inside, you discover this pretty amazing world. And if you know a little bit about Prince or a lot about him, I would say there are a couple other places. One is obviously First Avenue. That is it's a pretty amazing club. And it is, especially you know this, it is a really major fixture for music in this city. If you're a Prince fan, then I think you should also visit the Electric Fetus. You know, what I like about it is not just the fact that Prince bought music there, but it's still just a wonderful place.
Alan went on to tell me about opportunities for students to visit Paisley Park, Prince's recording studio and home later in his life.
We invite students, we encourage you, if it's a large enough group, we will find ways to get discounts. But we are open. I think one of the things about Paisley Park that you'll find is it's not just this pretty amazing kind of museum, but it's also what we call a creative hub. You know, and you won't just have the chance to visit and look at, you know, Prince's history and legacy and artifacts, but we also hold different public events, private concerts. So students in particular would be welcome at any time to a tour, but also as we end up having live concerts.
After talking to Alan, I got in contact with one of my professors from last semester, Professor Elliot Powell. Professor Powell teaches a course on Prince in the American Studies department that I took last semester, and knows just about everything there is to know about the Purple One. I had to ask Professor Powell the one thing I couldn't stand not knowing. When will there be new Prince music? And luckily for me, he had an answer.
And so it's my understanding that the estate has a lot of things planned, which are very exciting. The first thing that they're going to be doing is very much re-releasing a lot of his really late 90s and early 2000s work that has since kind of gone out of print. So there are a series of those kinds of things that I know that they're planning. Also, my understanding that they're working on a kind of re-release or a kind of deluxe edition of the Sign of the Times album, of the Parade album. And I think with those, as they did with the Purple Rain, you know, kind of re-release and the 1999 version as well, that it's going to be a particular kind of package where they're going to master these albums, and then we will have access to sort of unreleased or vault kind of material from that era. That's going to be really exciting. I think for a number of reasons, you know, Prince was always very much sort of creating. And so I'm really very much interested to see what he chose not to release around both eras. I'm really fascinated to see what they kind of dig up and how they package, how they sequence, those kinds of things. And so very much between this year and next year, we should have a lot more kind of Prince material.
After chatting with Professor Powell for a while, our conversation turned from Prince's music catalog to his significance in the music industry and beyond.
A lot of people kind of see him in a kind of way where they see him associated with one particular genre, right? That might be pop, that might be R&B, that might be rock. But one of the things that I do in my class, right, is always impress how many different genres Prince is interested in, that he's working with. And then the second thing is, I want folks to know how sort of politically active Prince was. Prince was interested in charity. He was interested in racial politics. These are really important things. He was very much invested in music education and making sure that money and politicians and other folks were very much doing important work around sort of music education, around issues of sort of police brutality, that these weren't necessarily kind of late in life things about Prince. Rather, they were very much early. Like, you know, one of the things that we talk about in the Prince class is really the Dirty Mind album and a song like Party Up, which is very critical about war, right? And this is his you know, third album that he's doing this kind of work. And so when I think about Prince and when people talk about Prince, one of the things that I think gets lost is how politically conscious and active he was.
Even though I came to the cities 40 years too late to experience Prince at the height of his glory, his influence lives on throughout Minneapolis. Everywhere you go, there are murals and memorials to his achievements. Prince was truly a hometown hero. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.
And finally, here's Emma with an exclusive interview with another Minnesotan celebrity musician, Maude Sun.
You might know Maude Sun from stories like this.
Actress Bella Thorne and rapper Maude Sun started dating about a year and a half ago.
Bella Thorne has spent a lot of 2019 feuding with her exes.
Are Bella Thorne and Maude Sun feuding?
But before Maude Sun was famous for dating Bella Thorne and a Daily Mail regular, he was Derek Smith.
Maude? I'm ready, Kevin.
That's Derek's sister, who lives with him now in L.A. But before L.A., Derek was a small-town farm boy in Minnesota, content to live in his own world.
And what was it like? It was really amazing. I think that's what, like, made me have this inherent imagination and, like, desire to live in kind of a fantasy world, because when you live on a farm, you really don't have any friends. You know what I'm saying? So especially when you're a little kid, it's like we lived on, like, acres of land, and so like just the neighbor's house was like far away, you know what I'm saying? So I'd play by myself like all day long. I just like decided to paint my own reality and kind of haven't left that ideology since.
Like his childhood, Derek remembers his parents' romance in an equally nostalgic light.
Well, my dad's crazy. So like my mom was like typical cheerleader, great grades in high school, and my dad was like the typical bad boy, getting horrible grades, not showing up to school, and wearing a leather jacket and riding motorcycles.
But that high school sweetheart, down-home living kind of lifestyle could only last so long. And Derek's parents divorced, and Derek left the farm for Bloomington, Minnesota.
Bloomington is like a suburb, so like, you know, it's not like I was in the hood. It's not like it was like that. But there's like a government section of Bloomington. And like that's where we started. We were literally living like off welfare, basically, like at the first place that we moved into. And then we moved every year of my life until fifth grade.
Derek's dad, he says, was a lifelong alcoholic, leaving his mom to fend for them all on her own.
We really did get like care packages and to just get by. And then my mom got this amazing job, and my mom is an angel and a really hard worker, and she raised both me and my sister with no help from my dad, legitimately. My mom was just like so good at maintaining this belief that everything was gonna be okay, even though she'd cry herself to sleep every night.
While Derek's dad was no role model, he did provide a foundational education in one thing that would prove very important to Derek's life: music.
And I was always like rebelling against whatever my parents were listening to. But my parents were playing me some of my favorite bands now, like the Allman Brothers. That's my dad's favorite band. And they were playing, I knew every word to every song on Eat a Peach by the Allman Brothers by the time I was five, legitimately. And like, didn't like it, didn't understand it. I don't know if music was my thing when I was a kid.
From a kid not interested in music to one of rap music's most polarizing artists, Derek actually got his start drumming in hardcore bands in Minnesota.
There was this moment, I was in this band called The Semester, and I was in, I want to say my like senior year of high school maybe. This band that I was in was, I thought, going to be my entire life, and I got kicked out of the band. Like, I got called and been like, you're not good enough to be in our band anymore. And it was on, so I was like fucked up in the head from it. And at that point, I was like, I need to figure out a way to not be shut down, to not be stopped.
And he really hasn't stopped.
Like, I did my first tour in a van at like 17 years old. I toured around the country in a van. I was pretty much touring 75% of the year from age 20 to 25. I'm on
Sorry, we're like mid-tour rehearsals. He's on his way up.
But constantly going comes at a price, and the price as well as the reward for Derek would be his transition into Maude Sun.
For, I would say, since the moment that I moved to California, I was on a very, very slippery slope of falling into addiction. And also, I definitely went through what would almost be like a very cliche Hollywood story, you know, came from a small town where legitimately, like, growing up in Minnesota, like, fame and fortune is a very big dream. You know, like the teen magazines and the posters on your wall and all that. I wanted fame since I was a little kid.
and that celebrity fascination never faded.
You know, the 27 Club is on my arm. These are my idols. There must be some kind
of way out of here. All Along the Watchtower by guitar legend Jimi Hendrix. He died in 1970, asphyxiation from vomiting after drug and alcohol use. People are strange. When You're Strange by The Doors with Jim Morrison. He died in 1971, heart failure from drug and alcohol use.
Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse also faced untimely deaths at the age of 27. And at 32, Madsen wasn't far off from their path.
Basically, the moment that I changed my life is I essentially overdosed and, you know, almost was out of here. The moment that I started feeling so much shame about what I was doing, that's when I knew it was wrong.
The lifestyle of fame, excess, and self-doubt was catching up to him.
Oh, I just made an amazing song. Well, I was on cocaine and drinking whiskey, so I mean, that had to have had something to do with it. And then immediately you're in this cycle of being like, well, that's me.
But that wasn't the only influence altering how Maude saw himself. In 2017, Maude's son began dating former Disney star Bella Thorne, who in the years prior had undergone her own metamorphosis of Miley Cyrus proportions, from Cece on Disney Channel's Shake It Up to a wild LA party girl. When the two began dating, Maude was thrust into the limelight.
I never looked at the Daily Mail website until, like, my face was on it. That point in my life, too, I was f***ed up. All right, that's what I am. I'm going to really play that then. You want to see the rock star? Let's go.
I'm going to play y'all a brand new song right now. My album just came out. Has anyone here heard my new album yet?
It's been a long road from Derek Smith to Maude's son, from life in Minnesota to fame, and from fame to addiction and addiction to recovery. And Maude still has a long way to go.
I know that at the end of the day, when I die, I do not want to be known for being a beautiful person on the outside. Like, I really want to be known like Bob Dylan, like a true musician, a true writer, a true artist.
With the Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Chekrun.
That's all for this episode. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Tosin Fasimo, and Casey McCabe. I'm Nathan Fervor, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.